because of decisions that he made that were uninformed and irresponsible.
Alessandra Biaggi, I want to thank you for being with us. New York State Senator representing parts of the Bronx and Westchester called on Andrew Cuomo to resign since February. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe.
KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Personnel Governance Committee will meet on Tuesday, August 10th at 6 p.m. instead of the second Monday this month. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
You're listening to an archival KBOO radio show from the tape vaults. Times, dates, and events heard on this recording are no longer relevant or have already occurred in the past.
From KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. On our show today, we'll examine the Afghanistan Papers, an in-depth investigation by the Washington Post based on newly obtained secret documents about the U.S.'s longest war. Then we'll discuss a new and disturbing book about domestic violence called No Visible Bruises. That's coming up in just a moment. From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. For 3 years, the Washington Post fought a legal battle to obtain documents of hundreds of interviews with experts and government officials about the U.S.'s longest war, still being fought in Afghanistan. The interviews were conducted by a little-known watchdog group called the Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction. Analyzing the documents in great detail, journalist Craig Whitlock and his colleagues published a multi-part story that they're calling the Afghanistan Papers. The expose confirms what critics had been asserting for nearly two decades, that there's no clearly defined goal or end point to the war to help determine when to stop fighting, and that our efforts have been futile at best and deeply destructive at worst. It also shows that officials have been lying about the war for years, and that our billions of dollars spent there have little to show for it. Before we turn to our guest expert, I want to play a short clip of a video produced by the Washington Post in its battle to obtain the documents.
Through these documents, these first-hand interviews from people who were involved, and yet this material had been suppressed for so long, that this was an original way to tell the story of all the failures in Afghanistan.
We're basically fighting the wrong way.
We just let the Afghans rip us off
because we didn't know how the story was going to end.
We are not really here to win.
In the fall of 2016, General Michael Flynn, who at that time was a retired U.S. general and intelligence director at the Pentagon, was working with Donald Trump on his campaign, and he was in the headlines quite a bit.
America first. America first.
And we'd heard there had been an interview done, a long interview done with Michael Flynn about the war in Afghanistan, and that this interview had been conducted by an obscure government agency called the Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction. Since Flynn was in the news a lot, we wanted to take a look at that interview, and so then we had to file a Freedom of Information Act request, and this dragged on for weeks, and Trump won the election, and Trump was president. Now Flynn was his national security advisor in the White House.
Good afternoon, everyone.
And ultimately, they denied us the interview. They said it wasn't a public record, so the Post had to file a lawsuit in federal court to obtain it.
Ambassadors, you know, local, down at the local level, everybody did a great job. We're all doing a great job. Really? So if we're doing such a great job, why does it feel like we're losing?
Michael Flynn was, just unsparing in his criticism of how the war was going. Then we found out that Flynn was only one of hundreds of people who had been interviewed by this Inspector General for Afghanistan over the previous few years.
And that's an excerpt of a video that the Washington Post created around the story that it has published in multiple parts called The Afghanistan Papers. Joining me to examine them is Matthew Ho, member of the advisory boards of Expose Facts, Veterans for Peace, and World Beyond War. In 2009, he resigned his position with the State Department in Afghanistan in protest of the escalation of the war there by the Obama administration. Welcome to the program, Matthew.
Hi, Sonali. Thank you for having me on.
I imagine that, like me, you poured through these Afghanistan papers and thought, I remember when I warned against that. Oh, yes, that was predictable. And we knew that Rumsfeld was lying, etc. Did this set of documents overall, of course, there are some revelations in the details, but overall, reveal to you that you and other critics of the war have been right for nearly two decades, for the entire, almost entire time it's been fought?
You know, I don't think any of us needed reassuring, particularly in light of the fact, not just in Afghanistan, but what we've seen happen in Iraq, Libya, Syria, and Yemen, Somalia, all throughout, say, sub-Saharan Africa, that these wars are not just immoral and illegal, but they're counterproductive. And so I think that context has always reassured, I think, folks like myself and then you who, you know, you've been speaking about this war much longer than I have. And I actually sent an email today to Barbara Lee's office, you know, representative from California, who was the only person who opposed the authorization for use of military force in 2001 in the United States Congress after the 9/11 attacks. And I sent her office an email because, you know, I just wanted to say, you know, I'm thinking of you guys. And I, you know, I understand the sadness that comes with this. I have not met any of us, Sonali, who have been speaking against the war, who are expressing joy or some kind of affirmation or, hey, you know, look, we were right. I think there's just a general sadness among all of us because we know the human cost in this. We know the suffering, not just for the Americans and their families and their neighbors who were involved in these wars, but for the Afghan people who have just been through 40 some odd years of unrelenting suffering that has no end in sight, as well as too, again, you know, put this in the larger context, all the people, the tens of millions of people who have suffered from American wars, not just for these last two decades, but, you know, going back, you know, really, you can make a straight line back from these wars all the way back through, of course, before the founding of the Republic, the wars against Native Americans, the institution of slavery, the doctrine of discovery, et cetera. All that ties in together. And so I think what for folks like myself, there's sadness, not any type of, you know, triumph.
One of the critical graphics in the Washington Post's coverage was the toll of the war, which I think has to be central to any discussion around this longest war. Tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of human beings have died. So the graphic which we've shown for our TV audience shows that since 2001, an estimated 157,000 people have been killed in the war in Afghanistan. That includes 43,000 Afghan civilians, 64,000 and some Afghan security forces, 42,000 Taliban fighters and other insurgents. And that includes 3,814 U.S. contractors, 2,300 U.S. military personnel, 1,145 NATO and coalition troops, 67 journalists and media workers, 424 humanitarian aid workers. So here's this war that has been claiming so many lives. And although you and I and other critics of the war knew that officials were lying about the war, this set of documents proves it, right? So they told, when they thought that their words were not going to become public, they told this watchdog group, the Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction, SIGAR, SIGAR, they told in very candid terms that we didn't know what we were doing in Afghanistan. And then publicly, they claimed progress. I mean, that's shocking.
Yeah, you know, these men, first of all, these men and women should not be considered whistleblowers in any sense of the fashion that you would ascribe to, say, a Chelsea Manning or an Edward Snowden or a Thomas Drake. These are men and women who, as you said, Sonali, thought that their words, that their truthful words were not ever going to see the public eye. And if you've noticed, if people have looked through the report and you've seen where the Post actually spoke to some of these men and women who are documented in these reports, almost all of them, with the exception of one that I found, Barney Rubin, who has consistently spoken out against the war, you know, for the last, you know, 8 or 9 years at least, all of them try and walk back or try and squirm out of it or say, I don't recall saying that, or, you know, or try and justify their comments. So what I think that shows to people is that this type of lying, this type of malfeasance is institutionalized. And we have seen, there's a book out by a West Point professor currently right now. There have been reports put out by the various armed services, including a major one in either 2010 or 2011 by the Army War College, about the institutionalization of lying in the military as a way to, one, show loyalty, and then, of course, two, to advancement and secure, you know, a profitable career for yourself. So I think that demonstrates the you know, systematic and consistent lying demonstrates that, you know, this way of war, the way of violence has to be propped up by lying, because it can only end in ruin. There's no, I mean, and we know this going back to, you know, the Greeks wrote about this. This is in the pages of the Bible. I mean, this is certainly not new human wisdom, but it certainly is wisdom that we have as a nation and as a people, in our institutions at least, have forgotten.
Now,
and
Matthew, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, I want to say one thing about the human cost. The numbers that you see in the Washington Post that you just recited, Sonali, as unbelievable as they are, those should be only be looked at as the bare minimum. If you look at what, say, like a journalist like Jonathan Steele writes about in his book, from a number of years ago, or his reporting from early in the war there in the early 2000s, you see that the number of, and from what I saw too being there, the number of Afghan civilian dead is a bare minimum. And the United Nations in its reporting says that. I would say, based upon my experience in both Iraq and Afghanistan, that whenever a U.S. helicopter or U.S. Marines or soldiers kill civilians, we only hear about that one out of five times or one out of six times, possibly. So much of the killing in these wars go unreported, as well as the fact that the war takes place in a rural Muslim population who is distrustful of the government, distrustful of the foreign occupation, buries their dead quickly in observance of religious and cultural rights. And then, too, it doesn't take into account, so we don't know what the actual numbers are. It doesn't take into account things such as, you know, the Afghan refugees are the second largest refugee group in the world amongst the world's largest refugee crisis since the Second World War. So how many of these people have died while trying to get to safety into sanctuary? How many of them are lying dead in the mountain pass or at the bottom of the Mediterranean Sea right now? And then finally, for the American casualties, the rates of suicide are not in there. So what we know from the figures of suicide is that more Iraq and Afghan veterans have killed themselves since coming home then were killed in Iraq or Afghanistan. If you're a Iraq and Afghan veteran in your 20s, you have a rate of suicide six times higher than that of your civilian peers who are your same age and same sex. So when we look at those numbers, we have to understand them as a bare minimum, that we're just, you know, that's the tip of the proverbial iceberg, right, in terms of the human cost of these war.
Conservative estimate and very likely a huge underestimate. In examining the Afghanistan papers, which I assume was named to reflect the Pentagon papers about the Vietnam War that Daniel Ellsberg had revealed as a whistleblower, in looking at these, a clear distinction is drawn between the Bush administration strategy in the Afghanistan war and the Obama administration strategy. You resigned from the State Department over Obama's escalation of the war, and I'm wondering if you can share, just from looking at these documents and seeing the internal assessments, how you view what Obama did. He basically threw troops and a lot of money and then created this sort of artificial timeline so that the Taliban knew just to wait it out at this war. And it was clearly a wrong strategy just from a pro-war perspective, right?
Exactly. Yeah, you know, if I was still in the military and I was still trying to, like, win victories for the empire, you know, I would not have, you know, the strategy itself went against everything that we know about the war, about the populace, about the people, and about the way of American war and what we're doing. I used to get asked a lot, what are the similarities between Iraq and Afghanistan? And this is when President Obama's surge was happening in Afghanistan. And at first I would fall into that trap and be like, well, you know, in trying to parse the differences. And then I realized, you know what, it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. Because the United States military is waging war against a people in both places, and the outcome is going to be the same. It's going to be suffering, and it's going to be absolute counterproductive method of recruiting for those people that we are calling our enemies. Because what you're doing is by killing their friends and family, killing their neighbors, you're just making their cause more worthwhile and more of a purpose-driven cause. What I saw there, because I had done two deployments to Iraq and also have worked at the Pentagon and the State Department on war policy during these wars before I got to Afghanistan in 2009 with the State Department, was that the Obama administration was no different than the Bush administration. They claim they were. They claim that, you know, they were just inherently better because they were Democrats versus Republicans. But the reality was that the Afghanistan war was a way for the Democrats to prove that they were a better, they had a better commander in chief, that they were better at winning wars, that they were just as tough as the Republicans. And that really comes down to why was it just not extended by President Obama, but why was it escalated? When he comes into office, we have about 30,000 U.S. forces in Afghanistan. By the end of his first year, there's 100,000 U.S. forces there. He's added 100,000 more contractors and 40,000 more NATO troops. I mean, so this wasn't a minor surge of 30,000, as is often misrepresented. This was a massive increase of 250,000 personnel to try and win this war, to prove victory for the United States president. And it was just, one, a colossal failure, but two, to go back to your point, which I don't think we could ever spend too much time talking about, is just more and more suffering for the Afghan people.
Yeah. Now, the other huge aspect of this was the amount of money that was spent on the war and in the war as part of the war. There's several aspects, certainly you alluded to it earlier. The Washington Post has a whole section on what that money did. It was about $1 trillion of U.S. taxpayers' money. That's my money, your money, every American taxpayer's money was poured into Afghanistan, far more money than the entire Marshall Plan, money that could have actually done some good in Afghanistan if it was put into the right places or used in the right way. But instead, so much of it went into to fueling corruption. One of the things that just shocked me and really angered me, just a tiny little fact that was one of the new things that came out of this Afghanistan papers, Abdul Rashid Dostum, one of the most notorious Afghan warlords, you know, documented mass killer, was receiving $100,000 of U.S. taxpayer money per month to behave himself. And of course, he became one of the two vice presidents in the nation as well. Just shocking. That's $100,000 of money that came from my pocket and your pocket and the pocket of every American taxpayer going into mass killers by way of the U.S. government.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you can't underestimate that term of mass killers. These men that we put and kept in power are as equally as bad as the Taliban. That is one thing that was suppressed, one thing that was just not allowed really to be spoken about in U.S. discourse about the war for the last 18 years, is that the people that we put in power were the people who killed tens and tens of thousands of their fellow Afghan citizens by shelling Kabul. These were the people who committed mass human rights atrocities. These were the people, actually. A lot of people believe that the Taliban brought the burqa to Kabul. No, the burqa was brought to Kabul by the very men that we put back into power, and either if they've passed away now, their progeny are still in power. I mean, it is just a cruel thing to say to the Afghans that we made life better for you. Yes, in some areas it has been made better. There has been relative peace, but in other areas there's been massive war. And really, most of the people who say that things are better in Afghanistan, if they are Afghans, very often are on the dole of the U.S. government somehow, or on the dole of the Afghan government. I would refer people to the Cost of War Project at Brown University. They have done really great work on how much this war is actually going to cost at the end of our lives, because, you know, I'm 100% disabled veteran. I get all my health care for through the Veterans Administration, and I have to get a lot of health care to take care of my problems stemming from these wars, both physical and mental. And so you have to pay for me until the end of my life. It doesn't end until then. And then there's all other costs that roll into it. But what they say at Brown University, and other studies at Harvard and other places have confirmed this, is that the war will cost at least $6 trillion by the time it's all said and done. $6 trillion. Of that, what the most incredible number is within it is that at least $1 trillion of that will just be simply in debt and interest payments.
Wow.
So it's a this war is eventually going to be just a $1 trillion profit for the banks.
And the Trump administration has restarted peace talks with the Taliban, which if the U.S. leaves with the Taliban in power, we will have, as I put it in my latest column about this story, we will have gone from point A to point B and back to point A by way of unimaginable death, destruction, and trillions of dollars wasted. Now, just going back to this issue of the way in which the money fueled corruption in Afghanistan, I just wanted to quote from the Afghanistan Papers, as the Washington Post wrote it, just because it's eloquently written. The U.S. engaged in a huge nation-building effort in Afghanistan, drenching the destitute country with more money than it could absorb. There was so much excess that opportunities for bribery, fraud, and corruption became limitless. One U.S. advisor said that at the airbase where he worked, many Afghans reeked of jet fuel because they were smuggling out so much of it to sell on the black market. Meanwhile, we're told there's not enough money for healthcare, for free college education. And of course, this week, Democrats joined Republicans, many of them, to pass the renewal of the NDAA, the National Defense Authorization Act, giving the military a $22 billion bump from the year before, taking out the bills that would have stopped the war in Yemen and Iran. And that all should be very much, this Washington Post story should have been part of that discussion on the NDAA renewal, right? But it wasn't. I don't think it was even came up unless it was by one of the opposition.
Oh, there's so much that plays into all of this that ties into it. The shooting that happened last week in Pensacola, where that aviation student from Saudi Arabia, you know, killed three people. He said, you know, that he is doing this not because he hates our freedom, but because, you know, of the United States bombing and killing of people. And it's what they all say. All these people who conduct these attacks against Americans, the guy in Orlando, the guy who tried to blow up Times Square, those two young men in Boston, none of them say convert or die. They all say stop bombing my people, stop killing Muslim people. That's what they keep saying. Mm-hmm. And that just gets, that doesn't even get recognized. It's because they called us a nation of evil, like they have some type of imbalance in their understanding of good and bad, what's morally right and what's morally wrong. But also too, as you said, with the NDAA, yeah, for, you know, members of Congress to express outrage and then turn around and immediately give this organization that has so systemically lied, not just about this, but about Iraq and about Libya, you know, and everything else, to go around, turn around and give them $735 or $38 billion or whatever the final number was, is just, I mean, I think everyone thinks of that famous scene in Casablanca, you know, where the police captain comes in and he says, I'm shocked gambling is going on here. And then the waiter comes up and says, here are your winnings, sir. You know, I mean, it's that type of, literally the one hand does not know what the other hand is doing in terms of members of Congress, because how in your right mind could you say first of all, say that you didn't know that things were going badly in Afghanistan, and this is the first you learned that the U.S. government and its military might be lying about something, and two, then turn around and give them $738 billion, when, as you say, Sonali, there is, I mean, hey, as people say all the time as a tagline, you know, Flint, Michigan still does not have clean water.
Well, finally, Matthew, although I was very impressed by the work that the Washington Post reporters did in putting this information out there and the legal battle they waged to obtain the secret interviews conducted by the Inspector General for Reconstruction in Afghanistan, although all of that was very impressive, the U.S. media, by and large, the corporate media in particular, really is in part to blame for these wars continuing. Don't you agree? Because critics of the war were not surprised by what was revealed. Because if you scratch the surface of official rhetoric, the evidence is there, especially if you're paying attention to what's actually happening on the ground. Do you feel that the media could have done so much more over these past 18 years?
Yeah, you know, absolutely. I think it's one of those things that makes me the angriest, is that the Post is now trying to wear almost like a cloak of being the hero. I imagine this is going to be their first entry in, you know, submission for next year's Pulitzer Prize awards,
sure.
Right? You know, I'm particularly, you know, you get aggrieved at this because you see the lack of adversarial journalism that has gone on for so long. In the Post, in the New York Times, you know, the USA Today has actually not been too bad, I've found, over the last decade or so. But for the most part, and then certainly the news channels, CNN, MSNBC, Fox News, very little a chance for anyone who doesn't speak in lockstep with the Pentagon to get on these channels, and to so very often, particularly say with the Post and the Times, and as well too the Associated Press and Reuters, you know, to go and just give the benefit of the doubt to the military and to print unnamed sources, anonymous sources, over and over and over again, without any type of attempt to fact check or to, again, play the role of adversarial journalist. And I know you know this, if you said something to, you know, and it's not just the major newspapers, it's also major magazines like The Atlantic or Time Magazine or whoever, you get, someone like yourself, if they even deign to read what you sent, they're gonna fact check you. You know, your eyes and fingertips are going to bleed by the time you're done, you know, qualifying everything you said. But you see all the time, they publish things from men like General Petraeus or General McChrystal without any source, without any attempt to speak to anyone who might think differently. And of course, without any ever clarifying or bringing up, hey, he's been wrong the last 50 or 100 times he's spoken. So yeah, I think that is probably the one thing where I'm really upset about and really emotional about with this, because the rest of it is, as you know, we said earlier, you know, there's no joy in saying, you know, I told you so.
Matthew, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, for all the work you've done over the years. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Sonali.
My guest has been Matthew Ho. He's a member of the advisory boards of Exposed Facts, Veterans for Peace, and World Beyond War. In 2009, he resigned his position with the U.S. State Department in Afghanistan in protest of the escalation of the war there by the Obama administration. We've been discussing the Washington Post's Afghanistan papers. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, subscribe to our video channel on Vimeo, and find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify. From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Violence against women is an epidemic that we are acknowledging and demanding justice for in larger than ever numbers in the era of hashtag MeToo. But violence that occurs in the home between domestic partners, the kind that we call domestic violence or intimate violence, is still unfortunately deeply invisibilized. A new and timely book called No Visible Bruises explores in visceral detail the toll of such violence on its victims. Its author is Rachel Louise Snyder, associate professor at American University. She's the award-winning author of her earlier book, Fugitive Denim, A Moving Story of People and Pants in the Borderless World of Global Trade. Her work has appeared in the New Yorker, New York Times Magazine, the Washington Post, New Republic, and more. She joins me to discuss this new book, No Visible Bruises, What We Don't Know About Domestic Violence Can Kill Us. Welcome to the program, Rachel.
Thank you for having me.
So you won your award for this book, the J. Anthony Lucas Award, and certainly well-deserved. In looking through your book, it seems like this is very much a book for our times. How do we define domestic violence? And of course, that's a term that doesn't really do justice to the depth of that violence. But we have so many different kinds of violence against women, right? Sexual assault and rape and the kinds of violence that can occur between strangers. But how do you define domestic violence?
Well, I mean, the problem isn't so much the definition as what we call it. You know, domestic violence is, of course, violence against someone that you know, generally that you claim to love. It could be a heteronormative couple, man against woman or woman against man. Of course, you know, same-sex couples, LGBTQ, parents against children, children against elder care, parent, you know, elders. So there's a lot of different variations that are included in that term domestic violence. But the problem for me is that it's so abstract, it doesn't capture really what it's like to live inside one of those relationships, what it's like to live in a house where that kind of violence is prevalent.
What led you to exploring this phenomenon? You've done work around the world on different issues, but why this kind of violence?
You know, I guess there's really two reasons. The first is that all the other stories I ever did that had to do with women and women's disempowerment around the world always had domestic violence embedded in them somewhere. So whether it was child brides or women jailed for love crimes or women forcibly sterilized by governments or whatever the issue was, domestic violence always was kind of adjacent to whatever was going on. And the other thing was that I realized we really have not had a public conversation about this. We're starting to have conversations about sexual assault in the Me Too era, but we're not having those conversations about domestic violence in the same way that we do with other social issues, you know, poverty or homelessness or mental health issues. We don't have anything like that with domestic violence, and I felt like it was time.
You begin your book telling us a story of a woman named Michelle Monson Mosier, whose father you went to meet and interview. Tell us her story.
Michelle was in some ways very typical. She was raised in a middle-class home. Her parents were divorced. She had two sisters, two very involved, loving parents. And she met a guy named Rocky when she was 14 years old. He was 24, and she was pregnant shortly after, had two kids by the time she graduated from high school. And eventually, when she was 23 years old, he killed her two children, and then killed himself. That is the Reader's Digest version of her story. But of course, as is always true of domestic violence, it's much more complicated and nuanced than it seems.
And this whole idea of domestic violence being a crime is unfortunately a relatively new-ish phenomenon if you look at the history of civilization. And in some countries, maybe it's not even that, right?
Not even that, yeah. I mean, it's stunning to me to think that you know, we in the United States, we think of ourselves as very progressive, as very modern. You know, we grew up thinking, being told all the time, this is the best country in the world. And yet we didn't have a federal law here in the States against spousal abuse until 1984.
Wow.
You know, you look at the whole history of humanity, and that is just a shocking fact. But there are plenty of countries today that are that don't decriminalize, that have decriminalized or don't have criminal charges at all against spousal abuse. Especially husbands against wives, right? Which is, you know, the majority of domestic violence. Although I do think it's underreported in, for example, Native American or indigenous communities and immigrant communities and LGBTQ communities. I think it's underreported and certainly under-resourced. But so there are many countries, Russia, Turkey, Iran, where there are no real laws against violence against women. And then there are other countries like Ireland and France where their laws are quite progressive certainly much more progressive than anything we have here in the States.
Here, every 5 years, when the reauthorization for the Violence Against Women Act comes about, we tend to have these political battles that play out on something that should not be an issue to be battled over, right? I mean, doesn't that even also reflect our reticence to treat this as the serious crime it is?
Well, in fact, the Violence Against Women Act, or VAWA, as it's typically referred to, has been apolitical since its inception up until about 2013. In 2013, it became politicized and suddenly became for the first time ever, Republicans didn't want to get behind it because the Democrats had written further protections for immigrant communities, for LGBTQ communities, and the Republicans didn't want to, they were uncomfortable with that extra resourcing. So it became politicized then. It did eventually pass in 2013, but now we see the 2018 Violence Against Women Act still has not passed. It passed in the House, has not passed in the Senate, and for the first time ever, doesn't have a single Republican co-sponsor. For the first time ever, it's just unconscionable to me. And it speaks, of course, to this larger problem that you're alluding to, which is how we see the safety of women and whether or not we prioritize the safety of women in those intimate partner relationships or whether we're prioritizing other things.
I want to go back to the story of Michelle Monson Mosier. In your book, No Visible Bruises, you spend a lot of time telling the story of the family of Michelle herself, of her partner Rocky, of their children. And I'm wondering why you spend so much time giving us those intimate details and going through their family dynamic.
You know, as a writer, my real challenge was how to get something that people have a very casual acquaintance with to really speak to them. And that really was the driving question behind how I wrote the book. I wanted readers to experience the loss of Michelle and her children and Rocky too. And the only way to do that is to make those people come alive as much as possible. And so, you know, I have a background in fiction writing. And so I approached the problem of how easy it is to turn away for people in this country. I really approached that as a fiction writer and was like, okay, how can I make us care? We know how this story ends. We know from page one of the book that Michelle is going to be killed with her children by her husband. So we know that. So what is going to compel someone to read further? And that really dictated a lot of how I approached this book, because that is what's at stake. What's at stake is that we are losing 4 women a day in this country to domestic violence homicide. 4 women a day. I mean, it's, you know, it's unbelievable.
And
every minute, 20 people are beat up in this country. Every minute, 20 people are assaulted by people they love.
And then, while you were in the middle of your book tour, your own personal social circle was rocked by exactly this type of story. Can you tell us a little bit about what happened when you were on book tour, talking about a book about domestic violence?
It's a savage irony is the only way I can put it. And I, you know, I'm somewhat limited because it's still ongoing, but mm-hmm. June 7th, I got off a plane. I had done an event in Ohio the night before and I got off a flight. And my daughter's close friend's parents, he had killed the mother and then killed himself. And his sister, so the father's sister, has been a dear friend of mine for 20 years. So I had multiple overlaps with this family. My daughter was a friend of theirs, and then the sister was a really good friend of mine. And it knocked me sideways. It's not like I don't expect domestic violence homicide to happen everywhere. Of course, I know as a researcher that it happens everywhere, that it runs across demographic lines and socioeconomic lines and racial and cultural lines. I know all that, but I guess I'm like everybody. I feel like even I would be able to see something or know something, and I didn't. I knew that they were going through a really, really toxic divorce. I don't think that's unusual. Many people go through toxic divorces. I went through one myself. So, but the drastic measures taken have really shaken our whole community. And I still am searching for words, for the way to write about it and think about it and make sense of it, I guess. And mm-hmm. and what is the takeaway?
And the fact that that you didn't see it coming, and possibly people around, even closer, may not have seen that coming, is that a disturbing hallmark of many cases of domestic violence?
I mean, it is and it isn't. You know, in fact, most domestic violence homicides have a certain set of risk factors that are common, and those okay. risk factors are on the danger assessment website. It's called dangerassessment.org. Anybody can look it up. There are 20 high risk indicators for domestic violence homicide, and they're things like are there biological children in the home that don't belong to the abusing partner? Is there ownership or access of a gun? Is there substance abuse? Is there economic instability? Is there strangulation, which is a different category of violence than or dangerousness than like a punch? So all of these risk factors, really only like two of them were in the situation with my friends. I think had there been any kind of physical abuse or I didn't know the couple super well. I knew them to drop off my children at play dates. I had drinks a couple of times with the mom, but it was really his sister who I'm really, really close to, and then the two daughters. So I wasn't close enough to the actual couple who are dead now to know, to be able to do a sort of post-mortem danger assessment on them. Someday I would like to. I think it's a little too early still at this point. But in most cases of domestic violence homicide, you can look back and see 17 or 18 of those risk factors apparent there.
In your book and the research you did for your book, the stories you explored, did you get a chance to talk to a perpetrator and try to get inside their mind?
Sure, many. Yeah, the entire second section of the book mm-hmm. is devoted to that perspective, because I feel like, when we pay attention to domestic violence at all, those of us who are in the media, we always tell things from a victim's perspective, which is the primary and most important perspective. But it also means that we're not expanding our research, and we're not trying to figure out the ways in which we can address the violence at its origin. So I sat in on batterers intervention groups, or offender intervention groups, if you will, all over the country. And, you know, there were things that were common. They tended to be narcissistic. They tended to rationalize their own behavior. They tended to minimize the violent incidents that they were involved in. All of those things were true. But they also were just everyday guys. Like, these are guys I would have had a beer with. It was deeply unsettling to see that, because I always felt as an educated woman, I'd be able to pick out an abuser, so I wouldn't date that person, or I'd have some, you know, antenna that comes up. And I learned that that really wasn't true. Anybody could end up in the situation of either being an abuser or being a victim at any point.
Did the men that were abusers see themselves as abusers?
No, right. Very rarely. I mean, it depended on the program. There were certain programs that made them sort of own their violence or own their proclivity toward violence, but that didn't come immediately. That sense of self-awareness that came maybe months into a program. And for some of the men, you know, pretty much all the batterer intervention groups I sat in with were with men who are court ordered to be there. So they're court ordered to be there. Many of them are on GPS. Many of them have just been released from jail for various, you know, domestic violence offenses. And they're still not calling themselves violent. They're still not seeing that. Or if they see it in their cell, in themselves, and they have come from a home where there was violence, which is true of many, many of them, they didn't see their fathers as violent. Instead, they empathized with their fathers and they talked about their mothers provoking that violence. So, you know, there's really a disconnect between people's behavior and how people see themselves in the world.
I'm just thinking of, as a mother of two boys, thinking about how boys internalize the social cues that they see around them as they grow up. And I suppose this is the sort of thing that people, you know, refer to these days as toxic masculinity in our culture. And of course, this is a cultural phenomenon, right?
It is. I mean, it certainly spans multiple cultures. It's not, it's, you know, certainly not just American, but I do think that, you know, for me, it's language is so important as a writer. And, you know, I've had many people say like, there's nothing wrong with masculinity, which is absolutely true. Like masculinity is necessary, right? It's adding that adjective, that word toxic, onto it that makes it so dangerous. And so I do think when we have, it's very difficult. I mean, I empathize with you as a mother. I'm raising a girl and I have a sort of different set of problems. But, you know, how do we say to our children, yeah, these are our leaders, but you don't want to emulate them, you know? Or yes, these are our leaders, but that's not really the way we should talk in public, right? I don't know the answer to that other than that I would like to not limit boys as we raise them, right? Their emotional constellation, their pain, their sense of self, their emotional intelligence, all of these things need to be cultivated in boys as they have been in girls for decades.
So after writing this book, or even really, I should say, as part of your book, what are the recommendations that you put forward to tackle this issue, at least on a legal, within a legal framework, or you know, just in seeing how our laws, which are there, ought to be applied better or maybe changed? I mean, we have the task of changing our culture, but what about the basic task of even changing our system?
That is a complicated question, and I feel like I'd like to give a complicated answer to it, I guess. The first is that I don't think laws change until society changes. I think that change comes from society demanding those changes, and then policy follows. So if you look at suffrage, or you look at the civil rights movement, or you look at the union movement, all of those laws came about because society demanded it. So I don't think you can divorce the need for cultural and social change from the advent of policy change. So the first thing I would do is, to say to people, we need to normalize these conversations within our own homes. Like in the same way that during the Brett Kavanaugh hearings, millions of women around this country were calling their husbands, their fathers, their brothers, their male friends, and telling them, oh, this happened to me when I was 13, or this happened to me when I was 15. These kinds of conversations need to happen around domestic violence. The other thing I would say is not policy oriented necessarily, but is program oriented, that I think we cannot arrest our way out of this. We have huge problems in this country with mass incarceration, of course, and with, you know, the racism inherent with mass incarceration. And you cannot add domestic violence into that and say we need to arrest and imprison our way out of it, because people don't come out of prison as less peaceful, as less violent. So I would look at some of the programs that are operating in other countries that we currently don't have here, that offer different kinds of behaviors and skill sets and knowledge to abusers. So for example, there's a program I heard about in another country that I'm hoping to look into a little bit more, that is for men, specifically men at the moment convicted of misdemeanor domestic violence, sort of low level violence. And rather than sending them to jail, they send them for 4 months, I think a minimum of 4 months, to a kind of halfway house where they go off to their job during the day, so they're still able to maintain that economic security for themselves. And then at night, they have group counseling and individual counseling and therapy, and they also learn things like housework and childcare and schedule management and all those kind of hidden tasks that women take on over and over and over again that men don't see. Right. Wow. And to me, that is really effective. There's also like batterers groups that have sitting adjacent to them, parenting groups. I think those kinds of things are particularly effective. And neither one of those solutions, if you will, involve policy changes necessarily. But they're things that we as communities can do right now. I can answer a little more about the policy if you want me to.
Sure. I mean, you know, because one of the things that I was reading about was how often to prosecute abusers, victims are expected to be part of the process and are expected to cooperate. And it hinges on their cooperation, and that can hamper investigations.
Yeah, there's sort of two problems with our policy currently, mm-hmm. as I would see it. One is that, yes, too often they require victim cooperation, which is controversial because our Constitution says, you know, you should be able to face your accuser. The problem is that we didn't have the knowledge and the nuance when the Constitution was written that we have now. And so we know that putting a victim in a room with an abuser and forcing her to testify in front of him further traumatizes her and also puts her in a much dangerous situation because she's going to have to continue to negotiate with that abuser once he's out of prison or once he's out of whatever it is that he is forced to as recompense, especially if they have children together. And so there should be more evidence-based prosecution with domestic violence cases. Police need to be trained to look for other types of evidence other than just the proverbial bruise, right? All kinds of trainings and programs that I talk about in the book for that. The other issue is that a lot of judges equate anger management with batterers intervention. And people ask me, like, who did you write this book for? Or who would you like to read this book? And of course, my answer has been everyone, but also specifically judges. Because when they sentence somebody like Ray Rice to anger management, what they're really saying is, I have no idea about the difference as a crime between domestic violence and other types of violence. And that means that they are missing all the important factors of that crime. You know, only about 25% of abusers fit that rageaholic that we envision. The other 75%, it's about power and control. They're enraged and they're trying to control one specific person. They know how to act at their job. They're not raging against their coworkers or their you know, kids' teachers or whatever. It's one person. And so anger management is not something that should be conflated with batterer's intervention. Right.
Finally, Rachel, I'm wondering, since we've been talking a lot about language in this conversation, and it's so important to you, as you were saying, we started out talking about how the term domestic violence is just an inadequate term. What would you like to see, or have you thought about a better term to describe this kind of violence?
Thought about that for a decade.
The search goes on.
Profound failing as a writer and journalist is that I have failed so far to come up with a better term. I mean, I do think that a lot of researchers have been calling it intimate partner terrorism for a lot of years. I think that I don't like the word partner in there because it implies just one type of relationship. But I do think intimate terrorism is a much better term. You know, back to the Michelle Mosier story in Montana, who I opened my book with, who was killed when she was 23. One of the things that her husband would do, there were two things that were particularly chilling to me. One is he would take the kids when he was mad at her, and he would go to a motel for the night or go camping, and she'd be sick with worry, not knowing what was happening, where they were. And so he coerced her into like compliance and obedience by taking the kids, which is not uncommon. And the other thing he did, which is equally chilling, is he went out to the outskirts of the city where they lived, got a rattlesnake and brought it home and kept it in a cage and told her, I'm gonna put this in bed with you if you don't do what I say. those two things don't involve any kind of physical violence at all. And yet, what do you call that? You don't call that domestic violence. I mean, that is a form of terrorism. There's a reason that researchers today are looking at the neurological makeup of domestic violence victims and comparing them to prisoners of war. It's intimate terrorism.
Wow. I want to thank you so much for joining us today, Rachel, and for sharing your time with us and for writing this very important book. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
My guest has been Rachel Louise Snyder. She's an associate professor at American University. We've been discussing her latest book, No Visible Bruises: What We Don't Know About Domestic Violence Can Kill Us. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RUWithSonali.
Rising Up with Sonali is hosted, written, and executive produced by Sonali Kolhatkar. Anna Buss is the producer, technical director, and web and social media supervisor. Our theme music is by Grammy Award-winning band, Gets Up. Like us on facebook.com/RU with Sonali. That's the letters RU with Sonali. And follow us on twitter.com/RU with Sonali. Our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can find all our programs archived and where you can get direct access to all our video and audio files.
Alternative Radio, and you're listening to KBOO Portland.
I think it's important to note that the decision of governments to support housing as a commodity or as an investment, and the complementary decisions to withdraw conceptually and in practice from housing as a social good, cannot be regarded as just, oh, any old policy decision. Housing is not gold. Gold is a commodity. Housing is not. It's a human right. Unfortunately, housing as a place of warmth, of security, and love, of shared stories and memories, is losing its currency.
That's Leilani Farha, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan.